We'll start here with session five. And as you see, the title is Who's in Charge Here Anyway? And you'll see a subtitle in your notes, or Why Can't I Have a Little Say in Life? And this begins discourse number two, which I've entitled The Secret of Providence. And providence has to do with God's superintendence or His control over all things. And remember, Solomon is goading people to think. And he has just addressed in discourse. Remember, there are four discourses here. And the first one we looked at was the secret of satisfaction, that life apart from God offers no satisfaction. And what he's going to show us in the secret of providence, the second one here, is that a life apart from God makes no sense. And again, please understand, you don't have to be irreligious or pagan or just defiant to not have God at the center. And as I said, we can be asking God every day and beseeching Him every day to do this or that for us. And God isn't the center of our focus as our satisfaction Himself. And that's the flaw. He is merely the one who helps us get what we think we have to be satisfied in the normal way of thinking. And that's wrong. And that's what Solomon is goading us about here. So he introduces us in chapter 3, in the beginning of this discourse, to some broad limitations for man. We're going to get at some specific limitations in the next session tomorrow. But these broad limitations of man, and so we start out here with the limitations of man. And the goad here is that God limits man's control of life. Now, turn to Ecclesiastes 3. And let's look at verses 1 to 11a. Probably these are the most well-known, maybe next to Psalm 23, are the most well-known words of the Old Testament to the secular world, because the Byrds made it popular in the 60s with a song about Ecclesiastes here. Ecclesiastes 3, to everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under the heaven. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck up that which is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to break down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to get and a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to cast away. A time to rend and a time to sow. A time to keep silence and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time of war and a time of peace. What profit hath he that worketh in that? Solomon said, verse 10, I have seen the travail or the sorry task which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. He hath made everything beautiful in his time or in its time. Well, what is Solomon saying here? He's saying, okay, let's look at our lives. We have a list of pairs here. We have 14 good times and 14 bad times. 14 minus 14 equals zero. What's the point of life? If you don't come out with a positive part of this equation, what's the point of the whole thing? And the point is, there is no point unless God is giving you the gift of enjoyment in all of these things and the gift of satisfaction. And so we say, we look at all these things. These are divinely, providentially given things, a time to die, and a time to be born, a time to plant. God determines that. You can't just say, well, you know, I think I'm going to plant in February. You can't do that down here in South Carolina and get anything out of it. And you can't do it in most parts of the states here. So you don't even determine the time when you're going to plant or when you're going to harvest. God determines those times. So who's in control? And what is Solomon is saying here? I've seen all of this. God runs this whole thing. So what's the profit of what we do down here? Most dissatisfaction comes in life because we can't control something. If you really stop and think about that, you'll find out how true it is in your life. Most of our dissatisfaction in life comes because we can't control something. We can't control the other person we think ought to be in our lives, or we can't control the other person who is in our life. We can't control the other people at work. We can't control the weather. We can't control much of anything. As I said, if you think you have a lot of control in life, you just understand you can't even get your cat to come in at night. We don't have a lot of control. The American way is go for it, make it happen, you can do it. You know what that is, folks? That's a fantasy. And so we think things like, I have to get my act together. Or I don't want anybody telling me what to do. I need to be in control of this. When they're in control of it, they mess it up. I've got to control this. I don't feel like putting all my effort into this when nobody cares. I have to know what's going on. I don't like surprises. I have to do it right or I won't do it at all. I will do it, but not if anybody pushes me. I have to be in control of even when I do it. If you will notice, most of the things in life, in fact, I think I could say all of the things, all of the dissatisfaction in life comes from something we can't control. Students at college, I see this happening a lot in college. You come to college, there's about as much similarity between college and high school as there is between high school and K-5. I mean, it is a major shift in a lot of things. You know, in high school, you know, you had a limited number of teachers and a smaller group. You kind of, everybody understood you and you understood them and you knew how to pull their strings. And, you know, yeah, I mean, you could pretty much control the variables around here and the friends and all this kind of thing. And then you get to college and it's like, here's the funnel of responsibilities and or the things that you can control and have to control. In high school, it's just kind of a small funnel, but you start going to college and the funnel broadens and now you have all kinds of teachers you've never seen before and they don't know you and they don't take into consideration all the things the high school teacher took in because she knew me and all this kind of stuff. And roommates I didn't pick. And maybe I don't like. And don't like me or something of that nature. So this is out of my control and my schedule is out of control and I gotta work these hours. I'm going to work this job, and I had to get this schedule, and I wanted this schedule, and the schedule was out of my control. And I forgot that I'm supposed to be able to be doing this. I'm really supposed to be at work right now, and I'm not even at work. I'm here worrying, and that's not in my control. And it just spirals out of control. And it's at this point in life that children who haven't learned how to look to God for help begin to spiral into a lot of anxiety problems. And I would admonish you moms and dads, if you've got young people who are nervous and agitated and fearful, you've got a lot of work to do right now. Don't wait till they hit college. And if you don't know what to do about that, then go to somebody who does know what to do about that and get some help. I am really, really concerned about the level of anxiety problems in our young people today in college. Because more and more of their life is spinning out of control. The economy is spinning out of control. One terrible accident in the country can mess up a lot of stuff. And life is going to become more and more uncertain. And if they're fainting with the footman, what on earth will they do with the horseman? When the real trouble comes. I mean, we're just talking about grades now. We're not talking about the health of your spouse. We're not talking about your own health. We're just talking about grades. And we have this much turmoil. And despair and hopelessness eventually hit. And as we've looked at on the way down, it dissatisfaction. Things aren't going the way I wanted them to go. I lack something I must have. I don't have control of this any longer. This is spinning out of control. This is happening over here and this is happening and I've got to have this. And their way of handling it is become very anxious. And all kinds of disorders develop from that. And it starts with the way a person thinks, what he thinks he must have. And it eventually ends up in despair. I may as well give up. It's not improving. It's not improving the way they're handling it. It's like somebody said, a fanatic is somebody who redoubles his effort once he loses sight of his goal. And when we're trying to make it happen ourselves, we double our effort and we try to pour more stuff into our part of the equation. And you know what? You do that for very many years, just trying to stack your side of the equation and thinking that's what makes it work. And you know what, folks? It will just flat wear you out physically. Because you're trying to do the things that only God can do. And that responsible person who, I've got to do it all right. I mean, after all, I'm a Christian. I've got to do it all right. And that what looks like an energizer rabbit of a person becomes a terrorizer bunny when the stuff doesn't happen. And now everybody gets the blunt of all of their force and all of their ridicule and all of their yelling and all of their push and all of their manipulation. And we just started out, we thought, just being a responsible person who is taking on all the responsibility for making life work. And people are falling apart by the droves. And it's a goad, folks, that we're doing this wrong. Our premise is wrong. I don't have to have this to make life work. But I do have to have God as my pleasure. Folks, satisfaction doesn't have anything to do with control. It has everything to do with the fellowship with the controller. God limits our control in life. Another thing he's teaching here in this passage is that God limits man's comprehension of life. Not only can't you not control it, you can't even understand it. We try to unscrew the inscrutable, you know. Look at verse 11b. Verse 11 says, he hath made everything beautiful in his time. He controls the timing here. Also, he hath set the world, or eternity, that's the word eternity, in their heart, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. So God says, not only do you not get to control this, but I'm going to withhold your understanding of a lot of what's going on. Now, this is absolute frantic material for the person who has to know what's going on about everything. And you know, many of us are not in extreme in this, but there's some of us who are. We're very, very, we have to know what's going on. Our way of making life work is to know what's going on. I mean, we're going to talk about it a little bit later. We have the paralysis of analysis. We never get around to doing something because we're always researching what is the right thing to do. And I know people who will not buy an appliance unless they have been on the internet and they have checked out every manufacturer of appliances and compared all of their features, and then they will go out there and search to find the absolute best deal in the world. Folks, the internet makes it possible for you to spend an enormous amount of time trying to find out stuff. And here's a person who's taking a lot of their security, they're looking to their own understanding to make life work and to feel safe. They're not accumulating money or accumulating relationships, they're accumulating knowledge in their barns as their way of being able to take their rest. Now, should we look for the best deal? Sure. How long should it take? Oh, maybe 10, 15 minutes or maybe 2 hours. Depending on what it is. If you're searching for a house, you're going to take more time on that than buying an iron. But some people take as much time buying an iron as others take buying a house. And God has said, I intentionally limit. I have put eternity in your heart. I put in you a desire to know the end from the beginning of all things. But what I've done is not given you the ability to know that. I've given you this desire, but then I've cut off your ability to do it. And you say, that's not fair. That's important because it makes us come to Him. And it's kind of like this. How many of you ever seen the Grand Canyon in person? I mean, you've been there. Patty and I were at the Grand Canyon just a couple of years ago for the first time. Folks, that's a big ditch. Now, I mean, that is an amazing piece of work out there. And I stand on the rim of that canyon. You're overwhelmed with the sheer vastness of it. And again, that's what I said. You know, you need to take time just looking at creation and seeing the vastness of this. I sat there on one of the rims looking at the, I can't remember which rim we were on, south rim or something, and looking at all of that and thinking, I wonder how many bulldozers and construction crews and how long it would take to do this. And God just drug His finger in the sand, and there it was. This is an amazing God. And it's a beautiful thing. I mean, there's a lot of dirt out here to see. Beautiful dirt. And it's like God has put this great big beautiful thing in front of you, but He makes you look at it through a telescope and you can only see 1 square foot at a time. Now, how fulfilling is that? And God gives us His whole life, this all of this eternity, all of the things that He is doing, and He doesn't give us much of a telescope to see this. We can just see little parts of it at a time. And folks, that's intentional. He does that just to frustrate us. No, He does that so that we don't take the thought that the satisfaction comes from what we can understand. It comes from the relationship with the wise God. I like the translation here that Dehan has of this verse, and it's in your notes. He, talking about God, has set eternity in men's hearts, but without giving man the ability to comprehend God's work from the beginning to the end. The next statement says, the key word in 3:11 is eternity. It's the word world in our authorized version. God has put eternity into their heart. This quest is a deep-seated desire, a compulsive drive, because man is made in the image of God to appreciate the beauty of creation on an aesthetic level, to know character, composition, and the meaning of the world on an academic and philosophical level, and to discern its purpose and destiny on a theological level, there is the majesty and madness of the whole thing. Wouldn't you love to know everything about everything? I really would. I mean, there's so many things I want to study. I wish I knew more about astronomy. I wish I knew more about art. I wish I knew more about paleontology. I wish I knew more about everything that I know that there is to know anything about. And I've got stacks of books I haven't even read that are at home that I want to read. Because I want to know more about this book. And I can take one topic on it, and it can take me years to study that one topic. And He's put within us this desire. Don't you want to know why God created Satan when He knew He's going to mess everything up? I want to know that. But you know what? He hasn't told us yet why He did that. And He hasn't told us a whole lot of things. And He's put within us this desire to know all of this stuff. I wish I knew a whole lot more about physiology of the human body and how it works. I wish I knew more about how the mind works. I wish I knew more about computers. I wish I knew more about my Volkswagen. I wish I knew more about everything that I know anything about. I wish I knew more about it. Don't you? And He's put in us this thirst to know all of this stuff, and it's a frustrating thing because you don't have time to know any of this stuff, or much of this stuff. And as DeHans Kaiser said, that's the majesty and the madness of the whole thing. It'll drive you mad if you think you've got to know everything about everything. So why does God limit our control of life and our comprehension of it? Well, here comes a nail, one of the first ones we've seen in the book. God limits us to teach us eternity, that the answer isn't found in the present. God limits us to teach us eternity. The answer isn't found in the present. Those of you who are faith here have heard me tell this illustration before, but a number of years ago, there was a girl in school who got into a real rage about something in her dorm room, and it was a very little thing. It was like, you know, somebody used her Kleenex, you know, out of her box or something like that, and I mean, it wasn't a big thing. But her reaction to it was just way out of proportion to the offense against her. And her dormitory supervisor dealt with it and arbitrated that little squabble and was telling me about it. And I said, you know, something's going on with that girl. I'd like to talk with her. Tell her she's not in trouble, but I just want to talk with her. So she came in, and I said, you know, I'm concerned about this because, you know, your roommate shouldn't, I can't remember the issue, but let's say it was Kleenex. Your roommate shouldn't be using your Kleenex without asking your permission. I'm not defending your roommate. But your reaction to this was far greater than the offense. And what that tells me is that there's something else going on here in your life. I said, you know, the way we would say it out west is that there's a burr under your saddle. And you get a cockle burr under a saddle on a horse, and he might get used to it with the saddle on, but you try to sit in the saddle, and the cockle burr, he gets the point, anyway, of it. And I said, you know, it's like you've got a burr under your saddle. Something else is really, really irritating you. And she just came alive, animated, and she said, yeah, and that's another thing, George Burns. And I said, George Burns? Yeah. And I said, well, tell me about George Burns. She said, he's 99 years old. You can tell however long it was ago. I don't keep track of how old he would be now if he weren't dead. But I said, okay, he's 99 years old. And she said, yeah, he's a wicked, evil man, and he's 99 years old. And my best friend's mom, God killed her with cancer at 40. I said, oh, I'm beginning to get the picture. And I said, all right, where is... So you're saying, why would God let a bad man live and kill a good woman? And she said, yeah. And I said, well, that's an important question. And folks, that's a goad. And I said, okay, let's think this thing through. How long is George Burns going to live? And she said, oh, I don't know. I said, oh, yeah, you do. How long is that man's soul going to live? And she said, forever. And I said, unless something happens in his life spiritually, where is he going to spend that? She said, hell, and he deserves it. And I said, how long is your best friend's mother, how long is her soul going to be around? She said, forever. And I said, where is she going to spend that? Said, she's in heaven. I said, how do you like it now? She said, not too bad. I said, well, you say that with a little too much glee about where George Burns is going. He said, I know, but he's an evil man. And I said, the point I'm trying to make is that God allows these kinds of experiences in a fallen planet to teach us that the final answers aren't in anything down here. And that's what Solomon is saying here. He limits us to teach us eternity. The answer isn't found in the present. And if you think you get your peace and your joy by finding out the answers of what's going on now, you're going to be a frustrated, anxious, and eventually despairing person. Because the answer isn't found in anything here. It's found in eternity. And what is God doing? He's catapulting us to consider eternal things all the time. And if you refuse to think that way, then you're going to be goaded constantly by the agony and the seeming unfairness of all of this. God limits man's control, he limits his comprehension, and God limits man's enjoyment of life. Chapter 3, verses 12 and 13. Solomon says, I know there is no good or nothing better for them but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life. Now, he's not saying, all right, I guess then all we better do is just try to make the best of it. That's not what he's saying. He's saying, you know, you can't control it and you can't understand it, but you know what? God has given us the ability to enjoy it when he gives us the gift to enjoy. So enjoy what you have. I know that there is nothing better for them but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. God can give you joy in your drudgery, what looks to you like drudgery. You say, well, you know, my job is just doing the same thing over and over again. Folks, the New Testament was written to churches made up largely of saved slaves. How much of their life was exciting? Same old stuff. Same old empty latrines to empty. Same old water pots to go fill. Same old tiles that have to be scrubbed. Same old stuff. Same old, same old. And life isn't really fun. I mean, they didn't have a pension program. And they didn't get days off with pay. And they didn't get vacations. Well, you know, we're going to take a trip on the Mediterranean. The only way they would take a trip on the Mediterranean is a galley slave rowing the boat. Where are they going to get their enjoyment? It's got to come from something beyond what is now and what is here. I really think a lot of the Negro slaves back in the 1800s here in the United States. I mean, they were mistreated. There isn't any doubt about that. And I'm not defending slavery at all. But and there were some godly slave owners. I'm not denying that either. I think they were blinded in an area of their thinking, but I'm not trying to impose our understanding on that generation. But there were some wonderful godly slaves back in that space. I mean, they didn't have a lot of education, but they knew, those that really knew the Lord, that enjoyment came from something else, because it sure wasn't going to come from the plantation. And they would sing things like, nobody knows the trouble I see. Nobody knows but Jesus. They had it right. And they would sing things. I mean, their theology wasn't always well honed. Or they would say, I got shoes, you got shoes. All God's children got shoes. It isn't just a master who's got shoes. I got shoes too, but they're up in heaven. When I get to heaven, I'm going to put on my shoes and I'm going to walk all over God's heaven. You know what they were saying? The answer isn't down here, folks. It's there. They weren't looking for anything to happen better down here. Now, they weren't hopeless and despairing because they did have an eternal vision. And they knew some things we don't know, and we've got a lot more Bible training than they did. But they knew enough to understand that the satisfaction in life didn't come from being able to control your life, because they didn't have any control over their lives. And it didn't come because you understood what was going on, because they didn't understand what was going on. Any joy they had was a gift from God he gave to the people who looked to him for the gift of rejoicing. And you know what? God gave them that gift. And a lot of those dear Christians who knew God were joyful believers. And they knew that God controlled the enjoyment. So again, we have to come back to this, that the meaning of life isn't found in any one of its components. I want us to think about going to a store I call Empty Mart. It's no play on anything that we have around here. Pastor's already gotten enough hot water. But let's say that you see this sign in life, you look at it and you say, well, you know, that go to that store and it says satisfaction guaranteed. And so you go into the store and you say, I'm going to go over to that materialism department because they guarantee satisfaction in this store. And you walk over to the materialism department and you look on the shelves and you walk around and around and around, and the clerk comes up and says, what are you looking for? Can I help you? And you say, well, I'm looking for satisfaction. And the clerk says, oh, we don't have satisfaction in the materialism department. In fact, we don't have satisfaction in this store at all. We don't sell satisfaction. Well, I saw the sign. It said, I know, but that's to get you here. It worked, didn't it? You're here. He said, well, I'm not leaving this store till I find satisfaction. Okay, so there isn't satisfaction in the materialism department, but there's got to be satisfaction in the friend and relationship department. So I go over to the friend and relationship department. Remember, this is called Empty Mart, folks. So I go over to the friend and relationship department and I walk around the aisles over there and look at all the shelves looking for satisfaction, and the clerk comes over and says, can I help you? And you say, yes, I'm looking for satisfaction in the friend and relationship department here. And the clerk says, oh, we don't stock satisfaction in the friendship and relationship department. In fact, we don't have satisfaction in this store at all. You saw the sign, didn't you? You say, I'm not leaving this store till I find satisfaction. And so you go over to the power and prestige department. Ah, here's where satisfaction is. If I can find satisfaction, it's going to be in the power and prestige department. And so you look around in that department, and the clerk comes over and says, can I help you? Yes, I'm looking for satisfaction. Oh, we don't stock satisfaction in the power and prestige department. But I thought you said satisfaction. Oh, I know, but that's just an advertising ploy, and it got you in here. But we don't have satisfaction here. I'm not leaving. It's got to be found then in the adventure and entertainment department. There's got to be a satisfaction, especially in the extreme adventure and entertainment department. And so you go walking around those, looking for satisfaction around those aisles, and the clerk comes over and says, can I help you? Yes, I'm looking for satisfaction in the adventure and entertainment department. And the clerk says, oh, we don't stock satisfaction in the adventure and entertainment department. In fact, we don't stock it in this store at all. And now you're really starting to get really angry. Because you thought sure that this stuff would have satisfaction in this store. They said, well, there's one more I'm going to try, and that's the lust and sensuality department. Surely there's satisfaction in the lust and sensuality department. And you go walking through those aisles looking on those shelves, and the clerk comes over and says, can I help you? And you say, I'm looking for satisfaction in this lust and sensuality department. And the clerk says, oh, we don't stock satisfaction in the lust and sensuality department. In fact, we don't have it in this store at all. Don't you remember? Don't you know that our name is Empty Mart? Now, what I have just illustrated for you is what Solomon is trying to say. You can look through every department in this store that guarantees satisfaction, but there is no satisfaction, there is no enjoyment without God. And if you don't take Him along, you don't get satisfaction in anything. It all turns putrid in your mouth. Now, what is the lesson for man in all of this that Solomon is trying to hammer home? What is God trying to do? He's trying to humble us now. Look in verses 14 and 15. I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. By the way, that word forever is the same word up in verse 11, He has set the world in their hearts. It's the eternity. I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it. And why does God do all of this? And God doeth it that men should fear before Him. Why does He do this? So that we will humble ourselves and say, God, I really do need You, don't I? Verse 15, that which has been is now, and that which is to be hath already been, and God requireth that which is past. We'll get to that portion in just a minute. To put us in our place. He humbles us now to put us in our place. Notice the next statement there, to root out our pride, which is the effort to take God's place. To unravel our self-confidence. To put us in our place as a creature under the Creator. The arrogant worldling is in your face. The godly man is on his face in humility before God. Just kind of a summary here. We look at the impositions when things don't make sense. God wants us to look rather at our inadequacy. Of course it doesn't make sense to us. He limits our understanding on purpose. Because unless he made these limitations, we would not turn our face toward him. You know what happened in creation? Before the fall, Adam found his sole satisfaction in turning his face to God and saying, You have done all of this. You are my delight. You are my joy. And then when man turned away from God, listened to Satan, turned away from God, broke fellowship with God, you know what the tendency of man's heart was then? To look at all of the stuff in creation and say, you are my satisfaction. And so you know what God did? He tainted the taste of everything in creation so it doesn't taste good. And so we turn our faces back again to him in dependency and say, you are my God. Take the world, but give me Jesus. You can take my health, but until I die, just give me enough consciousness that I can look to you. Folks, that is all we need. He limits us to teach us eternity, that the answer isn't found in the present. And another nail here, he limits us to teach us humility, that the answer isn't found in me. Our temptation is to feel safe when we're in control or when we know what's going on. The believer walking the way God wants us to walk is finding his security and looking his face to God and saying, God, I'm not in control and I can't control this, but you can and you do, and I trust you to do whatever you want to do. See, what we try to do is do a lot of the things God is supposed to do. God is supposed to know everything. I mean, he does know everything. I mean, that's his job, to know everything. It's his job to be everywhere at once. It's his job. It's part of his nature. He can be everywhere at once. He can know everything. He makes everything happen that happens. And you know what? What he intends for us to do is turn a trusting face to him and say, God, you run all of this, and you're the wisest, and I know you love me, and you do whatever you want. I'm finding my joy in you. You can take the world, but I want you. Well, that goes against the grain of our depraved hearts. Every religion, apart from biblical Christianity, is a man-made religion where man tries to make it happen on his own. He tries to control it. And what happens then is because, you know, I've got to be in control of all of this. I've got to know everything. And so we try to imitate those non-communicable attributes of God. We try to become omniscient and know everything. Or we try to become controlling of everything, omnipotent. We try to become omniscient and know everything about everything, and, or omnipresent and be where everything is happening that needs. Don't talk about me behind my back. If you're going to talk about me, I want to be there. We want to be omnipresent. You know, the problem is, folks, it takes a lot of energy to be God. It really does. If you try to be God, it will flat wear you out. Mortals were made to disintegrate physically when they try to be omniscient and omnipotent and omnipresent. They were made to disintegrate, and they do. Our trust can't be in that we can do all of these things, but our God can do these things, and he's given us certain things to do, and we do them faithfully because he's asked us to do them, but not, and we give our quarter because he's asked us to give our quarter, but with no idea that our quarter is what makes this happen. And we're back to this. We're dissatisfied and we try to control it. And it doesn't happen. We can't understand it. And it doesn't happen. I've got to know this. I've got to control this. I've got to understand what's going on here. And I've got to have control of that. And I've got to have this. But what we have to do is bow and say, God, you run all of this. And you know all of this. And it's okay with me, whatever you do, because I know you love me and I trust you. Notice the dependency in the following passage, 2 Peter 1, 2. And you notice it's not written out there for you, but it says, grace and peace be multiplied to you through the knowledge of God our Savior and of Jesus our Lord. How do you get more peace? By knowing more of what's going on? By controlling more of what's happening? You get more peace by an increase in the knowledge of God. Grace and peace is multiplied to you through the knowledge of God and of Jesus our Lord. In conclusion, I want you to turn to Isaiah 55. We memorize this as a group in the singles. Would you notice as we go through this, and I would encourage you, if you haven't ever memorized this chapter, memorize this chapter. Here is what our God, He turns to us and He says, "Ho, everyone that thirsteth, come ye to the waters. And he that hath no money, come ye buy and eat. Yea, come buy wine and milk without money and without price. Wherefore do you spend money for that which is not bread? And your labor for that which satisfieth not." Does that sound like Ecclesiastes? "And your labor for that which satisfieth not. Hearken diligently unto me." This is where you find it. "Hearken diligently unto me, and eat ye that which is good, and let your soul delight itself in fatness. Incline your ear, and come unto me. Hear, and your soul shall live, and I will make you an everlasting covenant with you, even the sure mercies of David." Boy, that was fulfilled in Jesus Christ. "Behold, I have given him for a witness to the people, a testifier of God to the people, a leader and a commander or a lawgiver to the people. Behold, thou shalt call a nation that thou knowest not, and nations that knew not thee shall run unto thee because of the Lord thy God and for the Holy One of Israel, for he hath glorified thee." He said, if you will come unto me and incline your ear and hear and your soul shall live, the nations will come to you and say, what is it that you have that we don't have? And here's what he says, verse 6. "Seek ye the Lord while he may be found. Call ye upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way of searching for this satisfaction. Let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts," his ideas of what he has to have. "And let him return unto the Lord, and he will have mercy upon him and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon." You say, "I'm so far down the path. There's no way to turn around." Oh, then you don't know our God. You can be a thief hanging on a cross moments before your death and say, "Remember me when you enter into your kingdom." And he says, "I will." That's the nature of our God. It's not too late. And then listen to what he says in verse 8. "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. For as the rain cometh down, and the snow from heaven, and returneth not thither, but watereth the earth, that it may bring forth and bud, that it may give seed to the sower, and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goeth forth out of my mouth. It shall not return unto me void, but it shall accomplish that which I please, and it shall prosper in the thing whereto I sent it." God says, "I will give my word to satisfy your heart because it will speak of me." And then I love this, the last part of it. Here's what he promises. "For ye shall go out with joy and be led forth with peace." And look at this. "The hills are alive with the sound of music. The mountains and the hills shall break forth before you into singing. And all the trees of the field shall clap their hands. Instead of the thorn, that desert brush, shall come up the fir tree, and instead of the briar shall come up the myrtle tree. And it shall be to the Lord for a name. It will demonstrate who He is for an everlasting sign that shall not be cut off." That's what God wants to do in our lives. But you seek Him while He may be found, and you call upon Him while He is near, and you forsake your way, and you forsake your thoughts, and you let His Word show you what He's like, and you forsake what you're doing, and you say, "Oh God, if You don't speak to me, if You don't minister to my soul, I shrivel up." Because that's true. And He wants us to bow. He does this to humble us now, and He reminds us in verse 14 that we will also bow in humility in the future, because in Ecclesiastes 3:15, He says, "And God requireth that which is past." There's coming a day when your past is going to be accountable. You're going to be accountable for that. Now, would you look very carefully at the conclusion? "Look," says the preacher of Ecclesiastes, "at the sort of world we live in. Take off your rose-colored spectacles, rub your eyes, and look at it hard, at long and hard. You will see that we think we pretty well have our act together, and then something very painful and quite inexplicable comes along, and our cheerful illusion of being in God's secret counsels is shattered. Our pride is wounded. We feel that God has slighted us, and unless at this point we repent and humble ourselves very thoroughly for our former presumption, our whole subsequent spiritual life may be blighted." I see this happening so much in folks in my age group, 40 and 50 and 60. And they have thrown their lives into this thing or that thing, thinking this is what does it, and then at the last minute it seems all to crumble. And their pride is wounded because I did it right and it didn't happen. And we call it midlife crisis or something else like that. And what it is a person who thought he had it all worked out, because if you just do all of the right things and pull all the right buttons and say all the right things and God ask God to help you get all this stuff together, then it works. And then when it falls through, they say, "God betrayed me." No, you just used God. And I'm not saying you were irreverent and that you weren't trying to do some things that were spiritual for God. But you have lived your life trying to asking God to help you fill up your side of the equation. And you thought it was getting all of that together and having all of that happen that would make life happen. And it's not that at all. And you know what the beauty of it is? Is that maybe now, going back to our equation that we looked at, maybe now all you have left